welcome to another podcast recorded at the 5th Annual STEG Conference held in the Economics Department of the University of Oxford. My name is Tim Phillips. STEG is a research initiative that aims to provide a better understanding of structural change, productivity, and growth in low and middle-income countries. For years, economists have hardly dared speak in public about industrial policy for fear of being laughed out of the room. Now, thanks partly to deglobalization and trade wars, it's back on the agenda. What does this mean for the process of development? And if more countries are going to embrace industrial policy openly, how can they do it well and avoid the mistakes that they've made in the past? Beata Jaworczyk of the University of Oxford is the chief economist at the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development, and this was the topic of her keynote at the conference. Afterwards, I had the chance to catch up with her. Hello, Beata. Welcome.
Hi, Tim.
Now, for years, we didn't really discuss industrial policy at all, apart from maybe in economic history. Why did economists dismiss it?
Well, industrial policies have a mixed track record. Import substitution in Latin American countries has not delivered many benefits. There is a view that industrial policy has certainly contributed to the success of Asian tigers. But over years, economists have become increasingly skeptical about the ability of public officials to pick winners.
Because it wasn't really in the conversation. Did this mean that on the ground there really wasn't much industrial policy happening?
Well, industrial policy has continued to be used, often in the form of export or investment promotion or in the form of industrial policy. But there was much less of it directed at picking winners.
Now, a couple of years ago at the STEG conference, Nathan Lane, I was talking to him, he's sitting where you are now, talking to him about his research into who is doing industrial policy, what kind of policies these represent.
Industrial policy is pretty prominent. 27% of the observations in this data set from 2008 to 2020 are industrial policy. And this is a data set covering all commercial policy. It's been trending upward through time. Since 2008 through 2020, it's reemerged as something governments do more and more.
I think at the EBRD, you have continued with that research and taken it on.
Indeed. Nathan and his co-authors have done wonderful work, pioneering work, building the first database of industrial policies. Mm-hmm. But more than 40% of policies they analyzed were not classified as industrial policy or not.
Right.
And that was in particular true of policies in emerging markets. So for instance, in Central Asia or Caucasus, none of the policies that were listed were classified. So we simply built on their work, we filled in the missing data, and we ended up with a new database of industrial policies on 140 countries.
140 countries. It's a huge database. It's extremely comprehensive. What does this tell us about the extent of industrial policy? Which countries are using it?
Industrial policies are back. They are experiencing a renaissance. The US and China are leading in terms of the number of policies introduced, but also countries such as India, Brazil, or Nigeria are following suit.
We need to discuss why it is making a comeback. It is the subject of the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development Transition Report for 24-25. And one of the drivers of industrial policy that you identify in that has been the competition for critical raw materials. Now, again, this is something that wasn't really discussed until recently. How is this driving policy?
Green transition is very dependent on minerals and other critical raw materials. And in recent years, we have observed proliferation of export restrictions on those critical raw materials. And because an export restriction can be introduced at the stroke of a pen, while developing a new mine takes more than a decade, there has been growing concern about ability of countries to source these critical raw materials. And this concern has been in particular fueled by growing geopolitical tensions. So countries are rushing to secure supplies both at home and abroad.
And what does this and other trends in industrial policy, what does this tell us about the difference between the sort of policies that are being used by developing countries and high-income countries?
Well, to do industrial policy, you need two things. You need money, so fiscal space, and you need administrative capacity. Countries that have little fiscal space and little administrative capacity opt for policies that are cheap and easy to implement. Unfortunately, these types of policies tend to be the most distorting one. So think about banning imports, requiring licenses to export, or banning any types of exports. Now, this is troublesome because many of these countries are no models of governance.
Uh-huh.
And therefore, there is a real danger of these policies being captured by vested interests and leading to a lot of distortions.
One thing that you're having to discuss pretty regularly at the moment, I've discussed this with you several times, is the fragmentation of the global economy that's going on. Is this being driven? Is it being accelerated by industrial policy?
Industrial policies can certainly accelerate fragmentation of the global economy. As we show in the transition report, 90% of industrial policies in advanced economies discriminate against foreign interests.
And these policies that discriminate against foreign interests, what are they trying to achieve? Can we see what their impact is?
They are trying to induce firms to purchase more locally.
My message to every business in the world is very simple. Come make your product in America, and we will give you among the lowest taxes of any nation on earth.
They are trying to bring more business to national producers. So think about subsidies that are awarded that are dependent on the share of local content.
But if you don't make your product in America, which is your prerogative, then very simply, you will have to pay a tariff, differing amounts, but a tariff which will direct hundreds of billions of dollars and even trillions of dollars into our treasury.
Industrial policy is a kind of slightly wonkish name that we give to these policies, but can politicians use them? Can they articulate them? Are they a vote winner?
Often they are, as politicians promise more jobs, faster productivity growth, better conditions, and more prosperity in lagging regions. Also, what we have observed over the last two decades is more positive views of the public towards state participation in the economy. There has been a remarkable increase in the number of people who would want to see greater involvement of the state in the economy. And we cite some striking numbers, particularly for post-communist countries.
Really? So that more people are interested in the state running more of the economy?
Yes, and we observed a big increase between the late 1990s and the pre-COVID years, uh-huh. And a further increase during the pandemic.
Under Tito, there was security. Under Tito, there was free school and university. Under Tito, well, factories even owned holiday homes where workers could stay in the summer. Some living in the former Yugoslavia, it is difficult to forget what for them was simpler times.
The list of outcomes that you said that these politicians are promising, it sounds great. I would vote for that myself. Is there a risk that governments will promise these outcomes using industrial policy but not be able to deliver them?
There is a real risk that these policies will not deliver because doing industrial policy well is difficult. So there's a real danger that governments will waste a lot of money without showing much in terms of benefits for the public.
Okay, so I was reading the transition report and right at the beginning, it says that the track record of industrial policies is mixed at best. So in your role, be your academic economist, Viata, is there any industrial policy that you would recommend?
Well, my personal favorite is investment promotion. So reducing information barriers, helping foreign investors navigate the bureaucratic maze. I have shown in my own research that these policies bring more FDI to emerging markets and developing countries, though they don't seem to be as effective in advanced economies. The reason why I like these policies is because they are relatively inexpensive and nothing happens if you get them wrong. The worst that can happen is no FDI will come in.
Right. Which brings me to the mistakes in delivering these policies. As a policy economist, what have been those mistakes in delivering that we can learn from if we want to do it better in future?
Very often, industrial policies have multiple objectives without a clear hierarchy. Mm-hmm. Think about the current situation in Europe. We want fast rollout of electric cars. At the same time, we want to preserve employment in the automotive sector, and therefore we have tariffs on imports of electric cars from China.
European Union countries have agreed to impose new tariffs of up to 35% on electric cars from China. That's on top of the existing 10% duties. The extra duties have been controversial.
And there is limited interest in continuing with consumer subsidies for electric cars. You clearly see that the first two objectives, fast rollout and preserving domestic employment, are at a direct collision course with each other.
So basically every department in the government wants its own policy, and those policies often don't line up.
Exactly. There isn't enough coordination.
So policymakers are going to be committed to doing industrial policy in the short term. It seems that they are. How should they choose those policies so that they can implement them well?
Let me just give you three principles.
Right.
First, clearly articulate the objectives of a policy. And if you have multiple objectives, have a clear hierarchy.
Right.
Second, industrial policy is as much about picking winners as it is about letting losers go. We don't want to freeze the structure of the economy, particularly at the time when green transition necessitates big structural changes. And finally, every policy should have an expiration date. Governments should not be signing up for continuing expensive policies forever, because often politically, it's very difficult to end a policy if you don't set an end date from the very beginning.
Let's hope the policymakers are listening. Beata, thank you.
Thank you very much, Tim.
The EBRD's transition report 2024-25 is called Navigating Industrial Policy. You can find it as a free download at ebrd.com. Also, Nathan Lane of the University of Oxford, whose work we were discussing at the beginning, has created an empirical research lab called the Industrial Policy Group with his colleague Reka Yuash. She's at the University of British Columbia. You can find information about their work at Industrial Policy Group, that's all one word, industrialpolicygroup.com.